Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief for Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there. We hope you're enjoying your turkey and your passive-aggressive family arguments today, wherever you are. Are you having any turkey, you two?
No.
Turkey's
awful.
Yeah. So today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Maitham.
Hello.
And our contributing reviewer, Layla Latif.
Hello.
Hello. So yeah, we're not going to be doing Thanksgiving today, are we?
I've never done Thanksgiving. Maybe I should, because it's just an extra like Christmas dinner, isn't it? But I've never really organised enough. It just creeps up and suddenly you're like, oh.
There's a lot of pumpkin involved as well, isn't there?
Pumpkin pie, yeah, that's always good.
Yeah, I went to an American Friends one once. Thanksgiving food isn't actually as good as Christmas food in that it's mashed potatoes, not roast potatoes, which I found very upsetting.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like the whole giving thanks bit is nice.
Yes. Well, let's give thanks for what we're talking about today, which is we are chatting to John Boyega and Paul Bettany, and we're taking a look at Uncle Frank, Red, White and Blue, The Happiest Season, Possessor, Jungleland and Noel. We've got quite the amount to get through, so shall we not hang about and let's get on the beat with this.
Lord, may you protect your servant Leroy. Please keep him safe for his police training.
Attention!
And grant us the wisdom to accept his decision.
At least this way, Dad, I can change things.
Get out of my house!
Out there, it's us and them. That's how it works.
Okay, so that's Red, White and Blue, the third film in Steve McQueen's Small Axe anthology, and this one is starring John Boyega as Leroy Logan, a real-life 80s poster boy for the police who fought to change the culture of discrimination from inside the force. Before we talk about the film, let's hear what John Boyega had to say about playing the role when our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell sat down with him, and they started talking about Boyega's first meeting with Steve McQueen, and then they went on to discuss, yes they did, Star Wars.
Can you take us back to the first meeting you had for the project with Steve McQueen? How was the story pitched to you? What did you think of the idea? Take us into that meeting.
We met up at a restaurant in central London. I can't lie, the food was dead. It wasn't the best. So the conversation was the best thing about it. And we just spoke about going on a journey together, really, and him wanting me to portray this man who still is alive, still is the same leader that he was. But we are capturing the origin story to this leader, especially within the community here in the UK. And then he told me about the format of the actual movies and how he's going to put them all together and his potential ideas for it. Yeah, the ideas of going through festivals and his ideas about this being a new sort of path to take in terms of obviously the current times and this being a really prolific story. And we just spoke about our backgrounds, got to know each other a bit because that was the first time I actually met him. First time I actually had a chance to meet him face to face. So we just spoke about our backgrounds, just the stuff that we, you know, grew up watching and eating, and just to get a sense of where each other is at. And I was Steve McQueen, so I was definitely sold on joining the project after that.
And what did he specifically tell you about Leroy in that first meeting and the story? It's something that I'm assuming you didn't know about.
Yeah, right assumption. I didn't know. And he just told me about a guy who was a scientist and gave up his old life to try and change the police institution from the inside out. And I found it intriguing because I was like, what circumstances led to that decision? Because if he has such a stable life, you know, why did he make those choices? And rather than Steve, you know, answer it as if he knew, he said, honestly, like, that's one thing I'm trying to figure out about him as well. He spoke to me about the kind of music he loved to listen to, his style. He actually met him prior. So he spoke about just the way he is as a man, you know, he's quite mature, and then showed me pictures and images from back in the day of this guy, of how he just used to dress, the kind of places he used to go to, and the conversation that he's been having with Steve thus far. And it was just a real nice take on who I could possibly be portraying. But obviously at that stage, I'm just kind of like, I'm working with Steve. It's a really good role, really important message. And it'd be great for me to do it, especially at this stage in my career.
And it is incredible. And can you talk to us about meeting the real Leroy Logan for the very first time? And how did your meeting affect your sort of acting choices with this?
We met up in Southwest London and it affected everything. I'd say 95% came from the conversations with Leroy, because everything is intentional with him. This is, in fact, a character study about the choices that he made. which are quite different to the choices that a lot of us make. A journalist actually told me today, he was like, you know, I wouldn't advise my child to do it. This is not the advice I would give. And so it was about me asking those questions, like, why, like, for this particular stage in your career, why make that choice? And having these conversations really enlightened me about certain scenes, his anger, or specifically where it came from, the way in which it physically portrayed itself. I think I asked him, like, didn't you ever, like, get into scraps and fights? And he said he did. He got into it with some certain people. Like, he wasn't the type to back down when he ever saw any kind of discrimination. And that helps inform scenes that Steve had in there, where I thought, like, wow, he actually took that kind of a stand. Is it more subtle performance? And Steve was like, nah, he's an angry dude. And then speaking to him, he was like, yeah, man, I got angry and I, you know, got in the face of the people that done certain things and always spoke out. So those notes in speaking to Leroy helped as well.
And then can you take us to on set for a second? How would you describe Steve McQueen as a director? What's he like to be with on set?
He's a creative guy. Creative guy, is chilled, quite funny, always willing to have a conversation. And at the same time, depending on the scene, if it's quite intense, he will definitely close the set, do whatever he needs to do to get you to where you need to be. I would say he's definitely an actor's director. He prioritizes performance over everything and truth over everything. He's willing to give parts of himself in order to get to an emotional place in certain scenes. He will, like, stop the set, tell you stories about his past, you know, personal stories too, and that would influence certain scenes as well. He's a well-rounded guy, and for me, you know, hence why I've said we're already going to be working on stuff together after this, you know, whether he likes it or not, but it's his approach to art that makes him so prolific in that space. And I think actors actually, they really, really can relate to that.
Steve told me earlier today that the Star Wars line in the movie was added after you were cast. And I just wondered, how does it feel to sort of say that line on set?
I just didn't think about it. I knew Star Wars would have been out 77. And that done very well in the UK. Some of it shot in the UK. So that would have been, you know, especially Lee and that kind of crowd, that would have been something that they would have said. Knowing that, obviously, it's a little that Steve put in there. It still naturally even works as well. If I hadn't been in Star Wars, I'd still say it. You know what I mean? So it's like, why not?
Very much so, yeah. And it does work. You were very brave in speaking out about Star Wars recently. And Steve talked about the fact that the Star Wars lines in the movie have extra meaning when you consider the parallels between Leroy and the police force and you within the Star Wars world. And I just wondered, what are your thoughts on Star Wars for the future? Do you think they will listen to what you said?
I don't know. You know, I can't speak for other people in terms of how they make choices. I just know that, you know, I've been open and having necessary conversations in terms of making it not a conversation that's the elephant in the room. I think we all need to realize that the characters that are portrayed in these big, you know, movies are as good as the moments you give them. You give them these special moments, abilities, powers, or whatever it is to help excite an audience. And it's actually quite a lucrative value. So when you diminish that of certain actors and it feels like it's just a specific crowd or a specific type of actor, a conversation needs to be had. And I think that conversation can be had. But in terms of the change, I'm not the CEO of, you know, Disney. Maybe if I was, I could tell you, but, you know, I don't know what decisions they will make. I know that conversations are happening because there are people that work in the actual departments that I know that are very, very open and honest in talking about things.
Thank you, man. And thank you for speaking up. Let's hope there is change.
Fingers crossed, man.
Okay, so Red, White and Blue, the third film. Did you like this, Layla? You've seen the others. You've seen Mangrove. You've seen Lover's Rock.
I've seen all five. There's also Alex Wheatle and Education,
which are coming in the next couple of weeks. Does this one match up to what we've seen already from the BBC at 9 o'clock on Sunday nights?
They're such an incredible set of films that it almost seems weird to compare them. I mean, they are pretty much five-star films. But then when you get into the minutiae of each film, you can see certain strengths and weaknesses when you then go back and you look at them as a whole. And I would say Red, White and Blue has got, in John Boyega and in Steve Toussaint, it's actually two of the best performances across all five films. Absolutely incredible work from both of them. But I do think the script for this is a little weaker, perhaps, than the others. There's quite a lot of exposition. There's quite a few scenes where they're just kind of laying out their motivations, laying out their feelings in a way that's a little unnatural and jarring. So it's weird then that actually the best scenes in it for me were the ones that were in complete silence, moments where they just, you know, hug in front of a car or there's an incredible like long chase sequence. I think it's a remarkable film, and I think it's an incredible showcase of John Boyega's talents and Steve McQueen's talents.
Yes, but you know, do you agree with John Boyega that that Star Wars reference that's plopped in there works?
Oh, it's so bad. It's cringeworthy.
It just takes you right out of it, doesn't it?
I didn't mind it.
You're a Star Wars nerd, though. But it feels really weird that, you know, he says, I'm going to join the Force. And someone says, are you going to be a Jedi? And you feel a bit, what is this doing in this film? But I agree with you. I think it's at its best when it's sort of loose and casual and it's more doing than saying. So I love like the scenes where he's around his friend's house in his leather trousers, boogieing down to music with his nice crystal glasses. I love all the music. The music, as with everything that is in this anthology, is amazing and really evocative and really gives you a real sense of time and place. And yeah, there's some beautiful shots, like you say, like a lot of car porn, isn't there?
Yeah.
Some great cars and shots through car windows.
I just felt that like some of the dialogue felt so unnecessary because like there's an amazing scene where this whole family is playing Scrabble and there's barely a word spoken. And I understood so much about them and about their dynamics and their relationships just in those few moments. So it's like, I don't actually then need them a little bit later on to stand up and be like, but this is how you raised me. Yes. This is our dynamic. But I mean, I don't want to put the film down. It's unbelievable. But that would be the minus column.
Yes. And, you know, like Steve McQueen at sort of his sort of not so great bits is excellent, isn't it? I mean, it's not like, you know, we're not talking about it's really dragging it down to don't see this one. It is just minor niggles, I think we'd say. Did you enjoy it, Matt?
I really did like this one, actually. Yeah, I love the first two as well. And as Layla was saying, obviously, they all offer something a bit different. And I thought this one did get a really nice balance of the kind of personal family side and the sort of political police side of the story. And the fact that it has this structure that's kind of familiar that sort of reminds you of those films like Serpico and that kind of thing where someone's, you know, going through the ranks. You've got something familiar to cling to, but it's obviously telling you a story we haven't really seen loads. And if anything, I actually just wanted a bit more at the end. I feel that they could revisit this and kind of continue telling more of his life story, because he clearly
has an amazing story,
a lot more
Logan.
To go. And especially obviously as John Boyega kind of taking the role so seriously, met the real guy and everything like that, I wonder if he'll revisit it in the future.
Yeah, it is quite short, isn't it? It's 80 minutes long. It's not as long as Mangrove and doesn't feel as sort of rich in that way. But certainly, I think taken as an anthology, it's a very nice entry.
Yeah.
So we are going to recommend this. We're going to say
wholeheartedly.
Yes, please do check out Red, White and Blue, which is on BBC One at 9 p.m. this Sunday. OK, so from one man fighting prejudice to another, shall we take a look at this one?
I never knew why Daddy Mac was so mean to Uncle Frank. He was the kind of person I wanted to be. Smart and funny and considerate.
You're going to be the person you decide to be. Or you're going to be the person everyone else tells you are. You get to choose.
Can I come visit you sometime?
Hi, I'm Frank Smith.
Oh my God, Beth, nice meeting you.
Frank didn't tell me you were coming.
That's because he doesn't know.
He doesn't know? Oh, well, okay, this is going to be very exciting.
How do you know Uncle Frank?
He's my roommate.
Wally and I lived together. We have for 10 years.
Never known anybody who was gay before.
Of course you have.
Choir director of church.
Mr. Jurgerson? But he's so...
What?
Religious.
So that's Uncle Frank, starring Paul Bettany as Frank, a guy hiding his identity as a gay man from his disapproving Southern family. And it's told from the perspective of his niece, played by Sophia Lillis. Here's Paul Bettany telling Adam Tanswell about the film, his dad, and the importance of accepting yourself.
Can you take us back to the beginning of Uncle Frank? What went through your mind when you read the script for the very first time?
I received an email from my agent with the script and also a note saying Alan Ball wants you to play the lead in his movie. Being a huge Alan Ball fan, I was poised to say yes already. And then I was slightly frightened that, you know, what if I get the shit Alan Ball script? You know, when you're opening a present in front of somebody and like, oh no, what? And then it was great. I found it incredibly moving. And I thought that there is a turn in the third act that is so elegant and brilliantly wrought, where the audience is convinced that they have now understood what is the original sin for Uncle Frank, for Frank. What is the root of his guilt and his shame? And then there's a twist, and the full, when the the full impact of that sort of narrative catching up with you is really, really beautiful and was on the page. And I thought how lucky I would be to be in a movie like this. So then we talked and it was lovely. So I did it.
And in what ways do you relate to Uncle Frank?
Well, I think that getting right with yourself is the job of growing up and the job of acceptance of who you are. And there's real power in that. When we got on the phone, we started discussing it and he told me his story, which was a story about his father. When Alan came out to his mother, she said, "I blame your father because I think he was the same way." He had a very, very, very close friend who died and he drowned in a lake and your father escorted his body back to the hometown. So for Alan, his father was dead at that point, so he didn't know and he couldn't ask his father. But he thought, what if that is the case? And for me, it was a similar what if. You know, I was raised by a closeted gay man who at 63 came out and then had a 20-year relationship with a man who I strongly suspect was the actual love of his life. When Andy died, my father went back into the closet, which was tragic, really. And he went back into the closet because of my dad was a Catholic and he felt a huge amount of shame regarding his sexuality. And of course, there is a cost being raised by somebody who has that big of a secret. So for me, it was an imagining of what if my father had been able to get right with himself and be okay with who he was and shed the shame that he clearly carried all of his life, which is incredibly tragic. So it was really nice to imagine a happy ending.
That's Paul Bettany chatting about his own experiences. Do you think that informs his performance? Matt, did you like Uncle Frank?
I did like it, yeah. I particularly liked his performance, actually. That was one of the main things I really liked about this film. So you definitely feel like it's something that he really cares about and it really feels like he's sort of giving it his all and not kind of coasting at all or anything like that. But the centre of the film is this relationship between his character Frank and Sophia Lillis's character, who's called Beth, who's his niece. And he's the kind of cool uncle that she really relates to. And then she goes to college in New York. Basically, the film is about them taking this road trip back home when his father, her grandfather, dies. And, you know, just the classic learning about each other along the way. I found it to be, yeah, kind of like nice and enjoyable. I never really thought it truly sort of soared, but I kind of enjoyed spending time with those characters.
What about you, Layla? Did it move you?
Not really.
Oh,
I would agree. I think Paul Bettany's performance is amazing. I just kind of kept looking at it and thinking like there's a really good film that he's kind of in and then everyone else is in like something a lot cheesier and broader. It kind of struck me as like a much worse version of August Osage County. And that might be because of Margot Martindale, but like those are kind of similar Southern, slightly tense family relationships. It didn't really work for me. It's a little too conventional. You know, you've got a lot of like relationships that get resolved. Those characters weren't set up for me at the beginning, so I didn't really understand the dynamics. So when there was then a cathartic moment, I was like, oh, well, I didn't really know that this was an issue or that this was a tension that you had. But, you know, I really liked Paul Bettany in it and Paul Macedi, who plays his partner.
Adorable.
Medici. Yeah, he was delightful. I'd like to see a lot more of him in the future.
Yeah, and it sort of tonally was a bit all over the place, wasn't it? Like there's the sort of comedic idea of the niece finding out that her uncle is actually gay and having this party with all these things. And then there's a weird boyfriend that's trying to crack on to Uncle Frank. And then there's these quite dark flashbacks. All of that, as you say, is wrapped up in this weird cathartic moment at the end that doesn't feel authentic or truthful to what we've previously seen. All I kept thinking as I was watching it was, they'd never say that. They'd never do that from what we've already been told about this family and the sort of darkness of this family to have this sort of false note at the end. It feels very much like a film that's been put together for Thanksgiving, which is when it's dropping, for people to watch and think, oh, families are great. When in fact, there's probably a much more interesting story about how they're not great. And, you know, this idea that Frank says to his niece at the beginning, you choose who you are, you escape from your family. That's more an interesting thread for me of how he makes his own life and chooses his own life, and so does his niece, away from this family, rather than having to sort of crowbar some sort of feel-good moment back into it.
Yeah, there's some narration at the end that I just found toe-curlingly embarrassing. Because, yeah, it was that thing. It's like they're just trying to, like, just resolve everything, and then it's all done, and then it's kind of a neat ending. But actually, life and family is always so much messier than that.
Mm, yes. And as you've both said, not to take away from Paul Bettany, who I think is actually one of his most interesting performances I've seen in a while. Obviously, we know him as Vision mostly at the moment, but I think this was really layered and interesting, and a sort of painful performance that I really enjoyed watching. So, yeah, we sort of wish Paul Bettany was in a different film, don't we?
Yeah, certainly.
So if you're looking for something that's sort of cockle-warming and is neat, as you say, Layla, and ties up loose ends, then it's going to work for you. But probably if you're looking for something a little bit deeper, not going to work. Make up your own mind. It is available now on Prime Video. If you're not having fun with your family on Thanksgiving, lock yourself away, have a little watch of that. Okay, it's in a similar vein. It's Christmas, and Harper hasn't come out to her family in this.
I cannot believe I've got all my daughters under one roof.
So her parents believe their straight daughter brought home her lesbian friend for Christmas?
Not exactly. They also think that I'm straight.
Have they ever met a lesbian?
This is why I avoid Christmas. It brings out the worst in everything.
I've always skated circles around you.
I love it when they do this.
You're such a cheater!
Makes it so fun.
No way!
Just be yourself.
But don't lie. You're a very bad liar.
Riley!
Harper.
This is Abby. Abby is my orphan roommate. I am an orphan, but we live together as friends. Like acquaintances.
Oh, please stop.
Yeah.
So that's Happiest Season. No, I've been informed. It's just Happiest Season. Matt?
Just Happiest Season.
What is going on in Happiest Season? What is it about?
So Happiest Season, obviously, as the title suggests, a Christmas film, one of the big new Christmas films for this year. It's basically about a young couple, Abby, played by Kristen Stewart, and Harper, played by Mackenzie Davis. And they decide to go back to Harper's family home for Christmas. But Harper's family don't realise that she's gay and in a relationship with Abby. So on the road trip there, Harper explains that Abby's going to have to be kind of posing as just a roommate and a friend. And it all just kind of, yeah, goes from there, really. So it's this family Christmas while they're kind of hiding a big secret in plain sight, basically. And yeah, very much fits the kind of Christmas movie and the kind of rom-com mold. I found it really enjoyable.
I loved it. Did you like it?
I loved it so much. And I'm not a huge Christmas movie person, but this really worked for me.
It doesn't overdo it, does it, on the Christmassy thing? It's there in the background, but it doesn't fall back on all the Christmas tropes.
Yeah, I also like the fact that it's smart, but it's not snarky. It's incredibly warm, and it really is about sort of love. That sounds cheesy, but it isn't cheesy either. It manages to walk this fine line, and tonally this fine line of being all those things. It takes the piss out of these kind of films, at the same time being a really excellent version of it. And I have to say, I don't think I've seen Kristen Stewart be more appealing than in this film. Yeah. I think she's fabulous in it.
Yeah, she's not exactly who comes to mind when you think Christmas rom-com, but she was absolutely brilliant. I think so many people in it were great. I thought Alison Brie, kind of doing peak Alison Brie as that kind of really uptight, over-the-top kind of alpha person. Aubrey Plaza, who was a lot more subtle than she normally is, was just so delightful. But for me, MVP is Mary Steenburgen, who was so, so funny as the matriarch of the family. And over the end credits, it's just her Instagram. And I laughed out loud about 16 times just with the end credits. Yes. I really, really like this film.
Yeah. And, you know, it's good fashion porn from Kay Stew as well. She looks great. She's just always wearing these little tuxedo outfits, but funny. As you say, you know, people have often complained that she's overwrought, that she's not got a sense of humor. But I think we saw that with Charlie's Angels. Like, she was the standout in Charlie's Angels for me in a film that didn't have many. She's great in this, and I really want to see her do more. And I also just loved the sort of relationship between her and Mackenzie Davis. I really believed in their love, and I really rooted for it. I wanted them to succeed and to be happily ever after.
I actually didn't massively believe in their love, because I think there was a lot of her being quite cruel and quite unpleasant. A big part of me wanted Kristen Stewart to end up with Aubrey Plaza, I must say.
Well, you know, maybe that's a Happiest Season 2. It hasn't worked out, and she's with Aubrey Plaza.
I actually thought Harper was a bit harsh a few times, when even if whether or not this was like a friend or a partner you're bringing back with you, she did abandon her quite a few times. And I think that's kind of super awkward to go to like family parties and things and just leave your guest just floating around on their own. But besides that, I did really root for them. And as we kind of touched on, I actually thought this film is one of those ones that's really kind of generous to all its kind of supporting characters, in the sense that, like, as you mentioned, Aubrey Plaza, she plays like the ex-girlfriend, and you could just easily imagine a way that character could have gone, you know, just the kind of horrible one who's the kind of fly in the ointment now. But even she's treated very kind of fairly. And
the ex-boyfriend as well. He's nicely drawn. And, you know, let's talk about Dan Levy. I mean, gay best friend.
Dan Levy has a monologue at one point that I was just in floods of tears. It was so wonderful. Even though he is playing a very typical Dan Levy character, but he does that so well that it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah, and he is, you know, he's the standard trope, isn't he? The gay best friend, you know, like the Rupert Everett in My Best Friend's Wedding. But I love that a lot of what he has to say is like proper feminist stuff. And he's like, you know, he's anti-marriage and he's like, you're going to ask her dad for her hand in marriage. She's, you know, like, oh, brilliant way to stick it to the patriarchy. There's some really smart ideas in there, but also he, again, really warm and wants the best for his friend and really just wants people to live their authentic life. He's great, but also bitchy and all of those things that you would hope he would be as well. And there's some fish that don't come out well, which I found amusing as well. Yeah. So yeah, an absolute barnstormer of a Christmas movie. I know we discussed this a few weeks ago, The Jingle Jangle, which was coming up highly as a Christmas movie to watch. I think this is the one to watch this season.
Yeah, this is the one to beat this year, definitely, I'd say.
We do have another Christmas movie to discuss. So we may have given away which one's the best. But we are highly recommending Happiest Season, which is on PVOD now. So get it. Okay, we're going to get back to that other Christmas movie in a minute. But first, let's switch it up with this.
You have a very special nature. One we've worked hard together to unlock.
Meow. So that's Possessor. Layla, you're the only one that's seen this because Matt and I could not get screeners to work. They kept running out, and every time we tried to get another one, that ran out as well. It feels like they don't want you to watch it because it's so good.
And this is like the film I most want to see this week.
I know.
Well, so
I really want to see this. So tell us what it's about, Layla, and is it so good?
It is really good. It's set in an alternative 2008 in Toronto.
That's specific.
Yeah. Brandon Cronenberg apparently wants us to be very clear. This is not the future. This is an alternative reality where assassins are able to plug themselves into people's brains and then kill them via someone close to you. So let's say if I wanted to kill Barack Obama, I'd, you know, put myself into the brain of one of his closest friends or family members, and that's the way that I do it. So Andrea Riseborough is a assassin, and her next target is Sean Bean. It is decided that the way that she's going to do this is to plug herself into the brain of his son-in-law, who's played by Christopher Abbott. And then a lot of it is done in kind of nightmare sequences as sort of internally the two people are battling for control, and you're never entirely sure who's making the calls. It is very exactly what you think of when you think of Cronenberg, in that it's a lot of nightmares, a lot of horrible technology, a lot of body horror, a lot of violence. He's kind of building on his dad's legacy in that way. It's really, really difficult to watch at times, but it is phenomenal.
Is it scary?
Yes.
Yeah, because Matt's a little bit, you know, you're a bit unhappy with scary movies at late at night on your laptop, aren't you?
Like Host we're talking about here. That's why I'm a bit too scared to watch that. But it's like kind of jumpy films like that that I'm more scared of. I don't mind kind of ultra violence. So that's
yeah. It's not kind of jump scares. It's more like, oh my God, this is hard to watch. Mm. I'm not even sure how he does it, because it's not so much that there's gore, but as he like holds on things for a really long time. So, you know, you're going to see someone get stabbed. It's not going to be for 2 seconds. It's going to be like a long shot, and you're going to really get a sense of like the violence, the pain. So yeah, not for the faint-hearted, certainly, but amazing filmmaking though.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit weird that he's sort of followed his dad so closely in tone and subject matter. Has he carved out a big enough niche for himself here, or does it feel like he's just copying his father?
I guess if you're Brandon Cronenberg, you can either do the complete opposite and just make like
make a rom-com,
or you can just like go all in on the family legacy. And I think if you're as good at it as he is, I can see why that's the appeal. Personally, I'm a person who loves practical effects and is just so filled with such cool ones. Yeah, I think it's a real feast for the eyes. Feast for the eyes if like that feast
not
is,
for the stomach.
It's gory body parts.
You know, I'm a bit troubled that Sean Bean is a target because he doesn't fare well in terms of death generally. So I'm intrigued to see if he's going to make it through this. No spoilers, obviously. But is he good?
He's great. But almost casting Sean Bean in a role feels like a spoiler in itself.
Right. Yeah. And how is Andrea Riseborough? I mean, obviously, she is not afraid to go to weird places. She's not afraid of this. Is she very compelling in this? Because she generally, I find, doesn't matter what film I'm watching, she is extremely good in it.
She is wonderful. So as we kind of meet her character, Voss, she's been doing this for a really long time. So she herself, from minute one, has kind of got a very tenuous grip on reality, which you can imagine Andrea Riseborough with her sort of alien-like intensity is just perfect casting.
Yes, I can. I so want to see it. Mm-hmm. And I will be downloading it when I can on Friday. So we are highly recommending that one. Let's see if Sean Bean can make it through. I don't have high hopes.
I'm rooting for you, Sean. Come on.
Are you?
I think maybe cue up the happiest season straight afterwards and check yourself out.
As a palate cleanser, if you're feeling a little destroyed by Possessor, follow it up with a moose boosh of happiest season. Okay, let's move on then, because we've got more to talk about. It's time to get in the ring with this.
You owe me money you don't have. I'm offering you an opportunity.
Battle Royale for 100K.
Take it to this address by this time next week, and Lion stays on the card.
You don't seem like a boxer to me.
What do you mean?
You haven't got that thing?
What thing? This thing? I don't walk around going like this to people.
I could kill you, but I'd never get a return on my investment.
We got one option. We fight.
So this is Jungle Land. Is it about a jungle, Matt?
No jungles at all in this. This is directed by Max Winkler, and it stars Charlie Hunnam and Jack O'Connell as two brothers. Jack O'Connell's a promising boxer. Charlie Hunnam's his older brother slash manager. It basically follows them on this kind of picaresque journey almost, where they, you know, getting in a lot of trouble, basically crossing with the wrong kind of people, and they get in a bit of a scrape with a gangster, and they then have to transport a girl to a location. And the girl's played by Jessica Barden from the End of the Effing World TV show. And it's basically, yeah, follows them on the road. So it's very sort of low key, very much kind of, you feel like it's indebted to those kind of films of the 70s, trying to be that kind of gritty character driven drama. That's it. It's pretty short. It's pretty lean. It's kind of, I thought it was interesting performances from all the three of them, but again, the film never really kind of caught fire for me. How did you find it, Layla?
I liked it a lot more than I expected. I felt it was really gorgeously shot, which I didn't assume was going to happen for a kind of gritty bare knuckle boxing film. It seemed like every scene was kind of 20% more beautiful than it needed to be, which I really enjoyed. I was kind of quite surprised by how tender the relationship between Jack and Connell and Charlie Hunnam was. And, you know, there's quite a few kind of weirder moments, not to give anything away, but with the people that they encounter. I liked it a lot more than I thought it would. You know, it's not the most wonderful film in the world that I've ever seen. I do think it sort of feels like a Safdie Brothers without like all of the great adrenaline that you get with that. But yeah, I would recommend it. There's kind of so much in Charlie Hunnam and Jack O'Connell's performances that it's compelling.
They are quite similar performers, aren't they? Some of the roles that either one of them has done, I could see the other one in that role. So I suppose they make sense as brothers. I don't know. It feels like this is also a calling card for Jonathan Majors, who we've seen in other films like The Five Bloods, and has been excellent in Lovecraft County, and has been cast in Ant-Man 3, so is joining the Marvel Universe. So is this a film you should watch to see what he might be bringing to that?
He's very minor, but it does seem that about 90% of the budget was spent on his outfits. Like, yeah. There really are some spectacular clothes. Yeah. So that's always enjoyable to see a beautifully dressed man.
Yeah, a nicely dressed man in a boxing movie. What's it sort of like? What would you like in this film too? Is it sort of The Fighter?
The Fighter meets Good Times meets Paris, Texas.
Nice. Good sell. I like that. Okay, so if that is your bag, that film is Jungle Land, and that is available to download and to keep and to rent from Monday the 30th of November on all digital platforms. Okay, should we get back to Christmas again? Finish off with a little Christmassy cheer. Bring on Anna Kendrick.
My name is Noelle Kringle.
Morning, princess. My partridge in a pear tree underwear needs washing.
Oh, well, then my Christmas wish has been granted.
Christmas runs in my family. My dad was Santa, and now it's my brother Nick's turn to wear the hat.
Stocking full of coal if I've ever seen one.
He saved a kitten from a tree.
Nice.
Noelle, will your brother be ready by Christmas?
Of course.
He's a Kringle.
I want to do this. No.
This is great.
No.
Let it happen. Ah!
This is not going well at all.
So this is Noelle, which is Anna Kendrick as the daughter of Father Christmas, whose brother is doing a bad job of it and she has to step in and help. Did you like it? Did it get your jingly jangly Christmas bells ringing when you watched it? Or did it set your teeth on edge as it did with me?
Meh.
Meh.
I just feel like with a Christmas film, you either have to be great, like Happiest Season is, or just go for kind of ridiculous trash and, you know, like all those silly Netflix Princess Switch holiday kind of thing. But this is kind of middling, mediocre. I don't think you're gonna laugh out loud, but you might be like gently amused throughout. And I kind of think you'd have more fun just watching a worse film somehow.
Yeah, you're a bit of like an Anna Kendrick fan, aren't you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased towards this film because I like Anna Kendrick and I do like Christmas movies as well.
Yes.
And this year, I would only give it like 3 stars. I wouldn't say it's an amazing film, but I did actually think it was enjoyable playing with the kind of Christmas tropes. And it's kind of a bit Elf. It's a bit Arthur Christmas.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of, yeah.
And Elf. I mean, obviously, it's hard to live up to, you know, it's hard to invoke Elf, really, you know, when you're kind of talking of modern Christmas movies, because it's pretty much, you know, the best, isn't it, really, of anything this sort of century, really. But I thought there were some funny moments. I like it when they sort of play on the mythology a bit and, you know, how Santa, you know, knows when kids are naughty and nice and that kind of thing. And the language thing, how she can speak these different languages. And I genuinely thought there were a few quite funny moments in it. I think that it helps that people like Bill Hader and Billy Eichner are just people I just find just naturally funny anywhere. They could basically say anything and I'd find it slightly funny. And then you've also got like Julie Haggerty and Shirley MacLaine in sporting roles as well. So I found it like, in terms of like an easy Christmas watch, I did find it pleasant enough to watch.
What is Shirley MacLaine doing in this, seriously though? I mean, did she know what she was getting herself involved with? Because Layla, you've watched The Apartment recently. So you've got the bar set high for MacLaine performances. How does this sort of figure on that?
It's sad. I just assume that there was a tax bill that needed to be paid or something like that, because she really doesn't get that much to do. Billy Eichner and Bill Hader do have like their funny moments, but Shirley MacLaine is saddled with very little.
Mm. And there is a cute sort of CGI reindeer. Did that do anything for you?
Some of the CGI is very iffy in this film, actually. Mm. That was one of the things that really made it feel a bit cheap, actually, because they've got some really nice sets, like in the North Pole world where they kind of spend quite a lot of time. I thought that looked really nicely done, but then they've got these really dodgy looking reindeers.
Okay, bar humbug on this one, I think.
I say give it a go.
It's one of those things, because it is such a great cast and such a great comedy cast full of like kind of comedy legends, that for all that, even when they're kind of not doing their best work, they're still amusing. It is frustrating to have a film where it's just like, oh, well, you know, you had Billy Eichner and you had all of these wonderful people and you had Shirley MacLaine and you still kind of did something that really is quite middling.
Mm. Yes, it has potential and probably doesn't reach it. So if you're into it, go and check it out. It's available on Disney Plus from Friday the 27th of November. Well, you may love it. We may be being sort of Scrooges here. Who knows? Okay, so that's it for this week. A lot to watch and a lot of different stuff. Quite a juicy week, don't you think?
Great week. Yeah.
So before we go, we do have a reader's question for you to answer. Are you ready? Who's your favourite on-screen Santa? Layla.
Okay, this is slightly cheating, but I do have a very good reason for it. But it is Jack Skellington in The Nightmare Before Christmas. And the reason is that I grew up in Sudan and I came over here when I was 14. So I also had a kind of later in life discovery of all the joys of Christmas. So The Nightmare Before Christmas really speaks to me.
Oh, that's lovely. That's a heartwarming and Christmassy story. I like that. Matt, the bar is set high now. Come on, what's your story?
Sorry, mine's far less heartwarming than that. But my favourite Father Christmas is Father Christmas from the 1991 Raymond Briggs animation, voiced by Mel Smith. More than anything, just because the age I was when I saw it, he's just remains the definitive Santa for me. And I think Santa needs to be a bit grumpy. I just loved seeing what he got up to like the rest of the year and his holidays and stuff. And as a child, it kind of seemed almost like a documentary to me. You know, I just literally just thought this is the definitive Santa year. So it's that for me. Yeah. How about you, Jane?
I mean, I think this says more about me than anything about the film, but I love Bad Santa. We watch it every year on Christmas Day because he's so miserable and so rude and dirty. And I have complicated feelings about that. And I just think it's really, really funny. And I like this idea that all the Santa Clauses that you see in malls or wherever you see them have these weird backstories and they're all just degenerates. I'm sure they're not, just to be clear. I'm sure they're all lovely people who have been through the police checks, so that's fine. And also, we won't be seeing them this year. They probably won't be queuing with kids to see Santa, will there? So well done to all those people who usually dress up in a really hot polyester suit and a big beard and sweat their way through Christmas season. We'll be back next year with that, I suppose. But yeah, Bad Santa is mine. So there you go. That's a heartwarming one, a miserable, degenerate one. And a cute kiddie one. Well done. We've covered all Santas there. Let us know what your favourite Santa is. You can reach us on Twitter or on Instagram. And we will be back next week with more juicy films to watch. And we'll see you then. Thank you to Layla and to Matt for joining us and for watching all those films. And we'll see you next week. Say goodbye, you two.
Bye.
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 Then I deliver all the toys without making a single noise. And I look at their blooming faces, so quiet. But I know in the morning, when Christmas comes a-dawning, there's bound to be another blooming riot. So jump up on my sleigh, and we're all on our way to another blooming Christmas.